Wehino Amadonai Eloheinu Alenu Ma'asedeno Kununa Alenu Ma'asedeno Kunaneo. Shalom Alechem Baruchim Abayim. Welcome everyone. We're continuing our classes now in the redemptive prophecies in the book of Isaiah. We're holding in chapter 41. It's the second in this series. You know, prior to our beginning this recording, the group here that I'm teaching, we've had a very interesting discussion. And I just want to review it a little bit and put it on record here for our recording. We were talking about an interesting issue about courts of justice. Justice. That's such an interesting word, isn't it? We believe that justice and law are supposed to be synonymous, right? Somebody wrongs me, I'm supposed to be able to go to court and get justice. Well, if anybody looks at any judicial system today, literally, anywhere in the world, anywhere in the United States, Western civilization, Eastern societies, Israel, anywhere, you will find that our courts are mostly courts of law as opposed to courts of justice. You and I, as laymen, cannot just go in front of a judge with another party, argue our case. The judge hears both sides and then a half hour later makes a decision. Doesn't happen like that. We have to have lawyers. Long drawn out experiences, depositions. This evidence is admissible. This evidence is not admissible. All kinds of rules and regulations. Ultimately, in the end, what we have is a perversion of justice. And what we have is the rule of law, but not the rule of justice. We can turn to the many famous great murder cases that have been popular, or I should say famous here in the United States over the last 10 to 20 years, wherein which people have been arrested on terrible crimes, but yet due to the letter of the law were able to be set free, whereas in other circumstances everyone believed they were guilty. So, you know, the fundamental human elements, which we call the seven laws of B'nai Noach, the predicated one, which is the foundation of all, is to establish courts of justice, not law, justice, wherein which righteousness, doing what's right, can prevail. And today, the one who has the more money, the one who puts on the better show in front of a jury, is the one who wins. Political agendas, social agendas, financial interests. These are mitigating, influencing factors. These pervert justice. And again, one of the Torah laws clearly stated that a judge had to be absolutely impartial. There was no concept of a jury of peers. I don't believe a jury of peers can in any way be impartial. First of all, what is a peer? So, average everyday citizens. No, they're not. You know something? If you are a Bible-believing individual, Jew or Christian for that matter, how can you be judged by people who are not of the similar faith? You could say they're secular. Well, they're my peers. Well, are they really? If people are of a conservative persuasion or a liberal persuasion, can they honestly, emotionally, fairly and honestly execute justice for those who might be portrayed in front of them in trial as holding views which you consider to be terrible? Does that not cloud the issue of how you might interpret the alleged facts before you in a trial and therefore decide prejudicially against them because of peripheral issues? Don't you dare say it doesn't happen. It happens all the time, every time. It's exactly what juries and trials and lawyers are all about. There is no more justice. The entire system, the society, is corrupt. Everywhere. The only point that I might say is of any redemptive value is that this is nothing new. This didn't start 10 years ago. 100 years ago, or 1,000 years. This is the way humanity has always been. Now,
Let's take this and apply it to our learning. Because the reason why I'm adding all this right here at the beginning of our lecture is because the question was asked to me by my group, what do we do about it? And I said, well, the answer to that's in Isaiah 41. So I said, you know, let's start the class. So I'm bringing you listeners all up to snuff here. Isaiah 41 is now going to speak about an interesting topic. When I prepared this lesson, my way of doing this before I read any commentary is to simply read the biblical text to get a feel and a flavor for it myself. To think how I understand it, what am I understanding, what am I seeing, to literally find and create my own questions. What does this mean? What does that mean? And then I turn to the commentaries to find my answers and to see how others have come to interpret this material. I was shocked and amazed by what I found in the standard commentaries. When I read Isaiah 41, and as we will see, it's speaking about the coming of one from the east. And I said, gee, coming of one from the east has always been a metaphor for the coming of the Messiah. And yet, when I read classical Jewish literature, I found in the older texts no mention of a messianic affiliation to these passages. Someone interpreted them as being applicable or a reference to the patriarch Abraham. Others said that this was an Isaiah prophecy regarding Cyrus, the king of Persia. I was not satisfied with these commentaries. I said, no. I challenged the fundamentals of each of those interpretations in the light of the individual verses, and I found them to be wanting. I said, no, these classical interpretations cannot fit into the text neatly. Maybe they are what we call midrashic, which means moralistic or homiletic, but they're not an actual meaning of what Isaiah meant. Before I checked out other more famous biblical commentaries from the Jewish Torah sources, I said, you know, I went online and I wanted to see what the Christians, how they interpreted this. And surprisingly, on the online Christian commentaries that I'd read, they said, we are going to follow the commentaries of the older Jewish commentaries. That really shocked me. I said, gee, the Christian commentaries are going to follow the Jewish? How interesting. I then turned my attention to what is probably the most valuable and important of Jewish biblical commentaries, surprisingly only written about 100 or so years ago, written in Europe by a very great rabbi named Rabbi Meir Libush ben Yehiel Michel, also known by the acronym Malbim. The Malbim commentary on the Bible is one of the most comprehensive and, in my opinion, in-depth and explaining what the text actually means. It has an entire section on the grammar of words. And I turn to him, forgive the term, religiously for my understandings of the biblical texts. And surprise, surprise, I found him saying exactly what I thought the text would say. Isaiah 41, like 40 before it and 42 and all the others after it, are what's called the Nachamot. These are the prophecies of the future redemption. Isaiah 40, as we learned, dealt with the coming of the Messiah, future prophecies. Obviously, then, 41, 42, and through the rest of the book are speaking about the same thing. No reference to Abraham, no reference to Cyrus, but rather to the coming of the Messiah. That is exactly how the Malbim interprets this chapter, and based upon his commentary, I'm going to share with you now my insights into this chapter. There has always been in Jewish tradition two different understandings of the coming of Messiah. All of the biblical prophecies state that before the Messiah comes, there's going to be the Great War. The Christians call this war Armageddon. In Jewish tradition, based upon Ezekiel, they call it the wars of Gog and Magog. You know, but ultimately, what is the moment that Messiah comes? The Christian theology has this idea that the Messiah is going to come out of the sky, right? And that is the moment when you see him, that's when he comes. Now, that obviously has Jewish origins from the book of Zechariah, where it says that Mashiach comes with all the angels with him. And it's a supernatural intervention from beyond. There is another interpretation in Judaism, wherein which it is thought that the Messiah, who in both of these scenarios is still a human being, born of a human mother and father, and how he grows up and matures, etc., and when he becomes Messiah, we turn to traditional teachings like those of Moses in Egypt, and refer to prophecies that state, as it was in the first redemption, so it will be in the second redemption. But the point made by scholars like Maimonides, Rambam, amongst others of that school, is that the messianic redemption will follow the natural course of life, the natural order of the world. The Messiah will be a political individual. He will raise up a human army, and he will fight wars, and ultimately will be victorious, rebuild the Holy Temple, and everything will follow the natural order. Then you have a good-sized school in the Jewish tradition which believe like this. However, in the mystical traditions, the prophetic traditions, I believe clearly shown here in Isaiah, reflected through Zechariah, and clearly shown in the Kabbalistic writings of both the Zohar, the Arizal, and others, the scenario is much more towards the supernatural. That scenario speaks, of course, of major upheavals in the world. That literally everything that we understand about life right now is going to be tipped over, topsy-turvy. That there is going to be complete chaos. And that Mashiach comes in a supernatural way with an army of angels out of the sky. That's what it says in Zechariah. Let's turn to our text and read within. Be silent before me, O islands. The prophecy begins. There's always mention of islands. Isaiah 41, 42 is mentioning the Eim. Aleph Yud Yud Mem, the Eim, translated as the islands. I always questioned, what islands is Isaiah referring to? Classical commentaries and Malbim alike say he's referring to the far corners of the earth. Now, from the geographical point of view of the land of Israel, from where, of course, Isaiah spoke, the islands at the far end of the earth could very easily include England, Ireland, Greenland, going around the world the other way, in the other direction, Australia, New Zealand, Indonesia, and Japan. Are these the islands to which he speaks? I cannot say. However, we define the term island and or continent is irrelevant. Remember, Isaiah is the one using the term, and what he is referring to is what he's referring to, but we have no identification. But the mention of these islands is rather prominent, as you see it begins our verse here. So somehow island places of habitation play a great role in this issue. And he says, let the peoples renew their strength, let them approach and speak, and we shall hold a trial together. In other words, what the text is saying here is that all of a sudden, the prophet is saying, be quiet. Everybody gather together, all right? Because judgment is coming. The translation I have here says, we shall hold a trial together. Something is going to happen where in which, from the far ends of the world, the people are going to take stock. Because something is going to happen where collectively They're all going to be brought together to be held accountable for their behaviors and actions. Gee, this sounds like the messianic scenario, doesn't it? The Messiah comes and is going to judge the nations. Of course, the older traditions say, no, this is the coming of Cyrus, the great king, and how he's going to defeat the nations. But again, I don't see it in that light. Who has aroused a man from the east, greeted by victory? Again, some say this is Cyrus, some this is Abraham, Malbim, and I say that, of course, this must be Mashiach. From the east, Me Mizrach. Mizrach is always referred to, not only just as a geographical location, but as a metaphorical significance. The Mashiach comes, and his job, as we know, is to execute, not judgment or the letter of the law, but justice. The answer to our question and how we opened up our class now. When do we rectify this situation? The answer is when Mashiach comes. He is greeted by victory because he's undefeatable. Who handed nations over to him that he was able to defeat their kings, turning everything into dust with his sword, driven straw into bow. It's an interesting choice of words, the Malbim states. First, this man of the east, he has handed over the nation. The nations are handed over to him, and only later is he able to defeat their kings. Malbim says, isn't it usually the other way around? Isn't it first that the kings go out to war and they are defeated and then the nations are conquered? Why is it here that Isaiah says almost the opposite, that the nations are conquered first and then the kings are defeated? And I contemplated this and I said, oh my gosh, there's a subtle little teaching here which is rather radical. Going back to our supernatural messianic scenario as outlined by Zechariah, and as I said, the Kabbalistic tradition, Mashiach is prophesied to come with an army of angels. Now, did you ever see an angel? It's not like you see how an angel is portrayed in a Hallmark greeting card, where they're looking like they're Norwegian with long blonde hair, wearing white robes with nice beautiful wings. Angels is described realistically in the Bible, not in some fantasaical myth. Real angels are described extremely frightening in appearance. They have multiple faces, different types of body, forms of fire. They're as big as houses. There's only one word that I think best describes to us how an angel appears, and that is extraterrestrial. And Mashiach is going to come with an army of these entities. How does an angel travel? God is omnipresent. God is everywhere. An angel? An angel is not God. An angel is a created being just like we human beings are. So, God, let's just say for argument's sake, will transport all the angels to earth. Fine. How then do the angels get around from point A to point B? Now, another question, just in case you want to say, oh, they're going to fly with their wings. So how fast do their wings go? Can they go Mach speed? Can they fly faster than an F-15? You better hope so, because if they're going to have to fight an F-15 in the air, you better hope they could at least catch up with them. Otherwise, the angels aren't going to really get their job done. And remember, they're not these entities with sweet blonde hair, wearing white robes. All angels in Jewish Christian literature are always referred to as having a sword, right? Michael the angel has his sword drawn. What's the sword made of? Do you think it's a sword of steel? How do you think that sword of steel is going to stand up, you know, to the sidewinder missiles of an F-15? You know, you got to think and recognize that our views and ideas and images of angels are rather mythological. The real angels that come, they're going to come. How they get here is a question. How they get from point A to point B is a question. Some will say, well, they're instantaneous in travel. Maybe they are. How do you know? Right? How do they get from instantaneous point A to point B? Oh, they just think and they are. Well, that's God's power. angels are created beings. They're not like you and me. Somehow, in some way, an angelic army obviously not only must appear in the skies over Jerusalem, but over the entire world. And their presence must be somehow, in some way, instantaneous. And their ability to conquer the world must be instantaneous as well. It doesn't say that the angels fight the war of Mashiach, but the people do. By the time the angels come, it's all over. Because as I understand it, when these angels appear in the sky, you can imagine the chaos, the fear, and the terror that'll grip all of humanity. That terror, that fear, is what is being expressed here in Isaiah 41. When the Messianic army appears in the skies, they're not going to be blonde-haired, blue-eyed Norwegian guys in robes with nice, you know, wings and harps. They're going to be the most frightening, terrifying, otherworldly, extraterrestrial entities that our minds could possibly imagine. And they are going to be everywhere, simultaneously, very visible, very physical to the eye to see. And the nations are going to totally freak out. And their mere presence will have literally conquered the nations. There's nothing you could do. Their presence will be so immediate that there won't even be time to dismantle a government. The governments will still be intact. But the governments, with the presence of the angels, will no longer have any authority, any meaning, any legitimacy. For these entities will intervene and immediately impose the Messianic kingdom. They're not going to have to launch an angelic attack upon Moscow and Beijing and London and Washington and destroy these cities and set them in flames and say, down with America and down with Russia. No. They're not going to be interested in such pettiness. They're just going to impose themselves, and that's it. They're not going to bother to burn up places. They're not going to bother to dismantle anything. They're just going to impose something new. And they're going to be there. And the nations of the world are going to see this, and they are literally just going to freak out. And that's when it says the nations are handed over to him. And only later does he defeat their kings. Meaning, only later is the neutralization of government. As he says here, turns everything into dust with his sword and driven straw with his bow. That their literal, their technological might, their military might is going to be so overwhelming that literally we can launch an entire nuclear arsenal at them. And however and whatever means they would use, they could just with a flick of a button neutralize the subatomic structure which holds the particles which keep these things in their form, and they just disappear. Everything just disappears. It just doesn't exist anymore. We would have absolutely nothing to hold them back. It says here, he pursues them, proceeds unharmed. Mashiach goes after the nations, goes after the governments, right? He pursues them. Nothing can stop him. And he does not tread the way with his feet. In other words, they're not saying here that he's going to go after them on horseback and running with his feet in literal means. He goes after them in other ways. You can interpret this literally. You can interpret it midrashically. Mashiach will get around, but not necessarily by walking. And he will go after them militarily. He will go after them politically, philosophically, ideologically, and comprehensively and completely change the course of human events. And now the prophet asks so prophetically, who did this? Who accomplished this? Wasn't this just an invasion from outer space like we see in all of our movies? And he goes, no. He who called the generations from the beginning, I did, Hashem. I am the first, and I am the last. The isles saw this and were frightened, and the ends of the earth trembled. There you go. When this overwhelming supernatural intervention in mankind occurs, which comprehensively shifts the course of everything that we know and understand, we're ultimately going to ask the question, well, who's doing this? Is it the Martians? Right? We're going to say no. This is the Creator. This is the source of all. And this was ordained from the beginning. You see, humanity as a race, we are destined to evolve. We are destined to rise to a point in our development where and when we will make contact with something other than our earth. And those or that entities will then take us to the next phase. Some will call that intergalactic, extraterrestrial invasion or intervention. But in religion, we've always known this. We call it the coming of Messiah. The leader of this army will be a human being, born of a human father and a human mother. How old will he be? Well, we don't know that. We know that he will be of the bloodline of David. Now, I'll share with you a very interesting teaching that's recorded in the Talmud. It states that on the day that the temple, the second temple, actually was destroyed, it states that on that day, Tisha B'Av, in the year 68 of the Common Era, the Messiah was born. And that his mother was seen lamenting. And they said, why? And she said, because my son was born and I knew through prophecy he was Messiah. But yet the angels came and took him away and to take him to heaven. And we read from all the mystical literature, the Kabbalah, that the Messiah was actually grown and raised in the Garden of Eden, metaphor for heaven. And then he comes back down to earth. There's a lot of teachings in this in the Zohar, in the section of Parshat Shemot, which speaks about him being in what's a place called the bird's nest in the Garden of Eden. This is what I'm basing this on. Now, where is this Garden of Eden? Where is this place? Heaven. Isn't that just another dimension? Well, it's real interesting, because I speculate, as I've done in many of my other writings, that maybe if the Messiah really was born on Tisha B'Av in 68 of the Common Era, and that's not just midrashic, moralistic talk, but if there is really something to it, then he was taken away off the face of the earth into an environment where in which he could age in a ways and means far different from that as we do here on earth. And that literally 2,000 years could go by on earth, which for him might just be 30, 40, 50 years, we don't know. Now, I admit what I am saying now is based upon my own ideas and views, interpretation of prophecy, Zohar, and other things. But, as we say in the language of Gemara, Hasvara notenet, meaning the pieces do fit together. It's very possible that this is this accurate scenario. That Messiah then comes with the army of angels, those who had raised him, who he has known all his life. And they come to impose an order, a natural progression upon the human race. What would be more frightening to the natural order of mankind than this? That the isles saw this and were frightened. The ends of the earth trembled. Who wouldn't? The nations draw near and come. Each one helps the next and tells him, be strong. What on earth could possibly motivate all the competing factions upon earth who fight with each other all the time to join together and to encourage and strengthen one another? The answer is clear and obvious. Only a greater outside threat. The East versus the West will always continue and fight and strife with one another until both are faced with a greater threat of annihilation. The verses continue. The craftsman encouraged the smith, and the one who smooths with the hammer encourages the one who pounds with the anvil, and says of the soldering, it is good. Then she strengthens it with nails, so it will not move. Or in other words, there seems to be a period where in which this intervening entity appears, and then the nations have time to unite forces to try to attack, and to attack into that great and powerful war, which we call Gog and Magog or Armageddon. But now the prophecy continues. But you, Israel, are my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the offspring of Abraham, my beloved. Being that it's referenced here to Abraham, I can't see how the previous verses spoke to Abraham. I took you from the ends of the earth and called you from its far corners. And I said to you, you are my servant. I choose you, and I have not rejected you. It is important here that we understand that the nation of Israel, spoken of here, is called God's servant. Because we will find through the rest of Isaiah mentions of God's suffering servant. And it is clear from this verse here and the other verses mentioning the servant, clearly identifying it as Israel and not as the individual Messiah. So those who wish to turn to the suffering servant of the famous Isaiah chapter 53, saying that's a reference to the Messiah, you have clear evidence from here in Isaiah 41 that the servant spoken of, it's not two different servants spoken of, it's the servant is the servant, the nation of Israel. Would not the Jews be equally afraid of an extraterrestrial intervention as would any other human being? We've all seen movies. We've all seen Earth versus the Flying Saucer or Independence Day or any of these others where the aliens come and attack Jew and Gentile alike without any indication of any division of humanity. We all know this. So therefore, if they appear in the sky, no one is going to say, oh, look, it's the army of Mashiach, Baruch Hashem, Geula has come, redemption is here. No, you're going to freak out. You're going to run and scream and hide. As it says in other prophecies, you're going to run into the caves and want them to fall down on top of you. Hide, hide, hide. Because you think the aliens have come. But God's word here, Israel, you are my servant. Jacob, I've chosen you, the offspring of my beloved Abraham. I have taken you from the ends of the earth, and I called you, didn't say yet he gathered, from the four ends, the far ends. You are my servant, you are my chosen, I have not rejected you. The first thing that the extraterrestrial armada comes to do is to gather the lost seed of Israel. So can you imagine armies of these bizarre-looking extraterrestrials going around the world and start collecting people, taking large groups of people? You're going to say, oh my gosh, what are they doing? They're gathering up these people. What are they going to do with them? Oh, terrible! If the world only knew they were gathering the Jews, they'd say, oh, you're taking the Jews? Oh, good, get rid of them. Ha, ha, ha. Finally, they're like the Nazis. That's how most of the world would think. But who is a Jew today? Who is a bloodline descendant, like it says here, of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, scattered as we are to the four corners of the earth? You will find pockets of the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in such faraway places as China, Korea, Japan, India, Mongolia, possibly even Indonesia, possibly amongst peoples, well, we all know, in the Americas and the Western world, and also in Africa. People who are not blonde-haired, blue-eyed whites from Eastern Europe, or for that matter, swarthy-looking Mediterranean types. All different types. Because the bloodlines have gone for thousands of years undetected. And this is all part of God's design and plan to protect the Jewish people. Good gosh. We have, I believe, significant archaeological evidence to validate a Israelite presence here in Mesoamerica, meaning in ancient America, amongst what we now know as the Native American tribes. So who knows where these angels by the hand of God are going to come to regather the people of Israel. But the gathering is not for harm, but for blessing. Fear not, the verse says, for I am with you. Don't be afraid, for I am your God. I will strengthen you and help you. I will support you with my righteous right hand. All your foes will be ashamed and embarrassed. What a sweet revenge that the Jewish people can look at their enemies, not as dead corpses. I mean, what revenge is there with a dead corpse? Can't say, I told you so. They will be ashamed and embarrassed of all those who pursued them and said, you're subhuman, you're disgusting, you're this, God's rejected you, God hates you, you're guilty of killing God, you're guilty of this, you're guilty of that. Finally, the angels come, and God speaks and says, no, you're my people. I haven't rejected you. And no matter how far you've gone, no matter how much you've lost your identity, I'm still with you. They, in turn, will become like nothing. Your enemies will be destroyed. You will seek them and not find them. Your foes who battle you will be like nothing at all. For I, Hashem, your God, have grasped your right hand, and I say to you, have no fear, I will help you. Those words, I think, are rather self-explanatory. There isn't really much other than to say that when the time of the gathering of the nations come, those who have specifically worked to the contradiction of the greater good of God's purpose on earth are simply going to be removed. It doesn't say they're going to be put, God forbid, in concentration camps and tortured to death. They're just simply going to be removed. God has an evolutionary plan for mankind. And those who stand in contradiction to that are simply going to be removed. That's all. Simple as that. Have no fear, you worm Jacob, O men of Israel. The Malbim makes a very interesting comment here, and he states the difference between worm Jacob and men Israel. He says there are two types of people, those who are like worms and those who are like men. Your average everyday rank and file person don't really care, don't really think, aren't really involved. They just live, eat and drink, and tomorrow they die. They're worm food. Those we metaphorically refer to as Jacob. And yet, there's the higher caliber, the righteous, the holy, those who seek out heaven, those who live by a higher standard than just that which their physical needs and body dictates. Those are called Israel. The subtle message here is God is speaking to everybody. All the different types. If you're of the promised bloodline, you're included. And it says, I am your help, says God, your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. And now he uses this interesting metaphor. I have made you into a new grooved threshing board with sharp teeth. You will thresh the mountains and crush them, and you will make the hills like chaff. You will winnow them, and the wind will carry them off. You will rejoice in God and exult in the Holy One of Israel. It's an interesting, but the one who's doing these deeds are the Israelites, the children of Israel. They are meant to literally change the course, or I should say change the face of the earth. No, I don't think God's going to actually make everybody, take and thresh mountains. I don't think we're going to really be doing, geographical, changes on the earth here. This is obviously a metaphor for saying that we are really going to clean up. We're going to crush all the opposition referred to here as the great mountains. How? Militaristically or ideologically? With a sword in hand or word of mouth? Now that's a good question. Those details are not given here. Ultimately, however, there will be such a comprehensive, overwhelming change that literally you're going to grind the opposition. It's not going to be because evolution is going to be so overwhelming and so sudden that all opposition is going to be destroyed. Verse 17, the poor and the needy seek water, but there is none. Their tongue is parched with thirst. Some interpret this as being the case of the Jewish people in exile in the wilderness, waiting for the salvation to come. Others refer to this in light of what we've just read about how the nations of the world have literally stripped the world dry of God's wisdom, God's word, that there is such a comprehensive lack of justice, loss of truth, that the nations are thirsty, they're parched. And God says, I will answer them. I, the Lord of Israel, will not abandon them. I will open up streams on the bare hills, springs in the plain. I will turn the desert into ponds of water and dry lands into sources of water. Literally speaking, if the children of Israel are out in the desert, literally running for their lives, God will provide for them. He will provide streams and flows of water from underneath the ground. If this is the metaphorical, then God is going to take from even the most faraway places knowledge, wisdom, enlightenment, understanding, and he is going to provide justice for everybody, truth for everybody, to fulfill prophecies spoken by Jeremiah, Isaiah, and other places, that all the world will know the truth. There's no longer going to be ideologies, different religions, faiths. Everyone is going to know the truth. Not because the sword is at your throat, or because you were told that this is the truth. Rather, you will see it with your own eyes. You will drink the waters, and they will revive you. See, this is the great blessing of the Messianic era. There will be an absolute integration of truth, religious truth, with science truth. Everyone will know and see the reality of things. There will no longer have to be an argument. If I say to you, there is something called the law of gravity, and whatever goes up must come down, you could argue it, debate it. And I'll say, here, take this rock, throw it up in the air and see what happens, right? It goes up, comes down. There you go, end of argument. Everybody will know. No one's going to debate it. There is a God. There is a heaven. There are angels. There is a way. There is a Torah. There is a promise. There is a covenant. It'll be just as clear and evident as the air we breathe and the force of gravity which binds us to the earth. No argument. No discussion. No debate. It just will be. I will plant cedars in the desert, acacias and myrtles and olive wood, and I will also set cypress trees, pines, and box trees in the wilderness again. Metaphors that in the most driest of places, life will come, so that men may see and know, consider and reflect that it is God's hand that has accomplished this, and the Holy One of Israel has performed it. No blaming it on the aliens. It's not the Martians. It comes only from the source, the one true source of all. Now, turning to the nations, submit your case, says God. Offer your pleas, says the King of Jacob. Let them approach. Tell us what has happened, all right? Tell us what will happen in the past, right? And we will consider it, that we may know what will come of it. Maybe you can tell us future events. Isaiah is almost speaking in a mocking tone, that we may know them. Predict the future, and then we can admit that you're gods. Do good, do bad. Let us, that we may fear and see. But then, they have nothing to offer. So he says, you are less than nothing, and your achievements are non-existent. Whoever chooses you is an abomination. Think about this. When all the nations of the world have to face the extraterrestrial overwhelming force of Mashiach, what are they going to say? Oh, I guess you are the Messiah, the promised one of the Bible. Here we surrender to you. You really think that's what the world is going to say? Come on now. They're going to say, we will not submit. We will not surrender. And there's going to be justice. There will be a big old trial. And all of the history of mankind is going to be reviewed. What every nation has done, and their motivations, their intent, and their true actions and behaviors. And we will see that everything is non-existent. It's all garbage. Total waste. And now, verse 25 says something interesting. I have aroused him from the north. And then continues, the one who calls my name from the east. And he has come. Some commentaries interpret this as being talking about the same guy. The Malbim says, oh no, this is two. The guy who is aroused from the north is the one we call Armilos, or what the Christians call the Antichrist. And you have to read that as almost comma. And then the one who calls upon my name as a reference to the Messiah, he comes from the east. In other words, another metaphor. And he's come. And then he will trample the rulers like mud, and a potter, like a potter treading clay. That even the greatest of the nations will just be destroyed before Mashiach. Now, who foretold this from the beginning, that we might know it? And from the start, that we might say, he, meaning God, was right. No one foretold it, and no one predicted it. No one heard your words. And this is what the nations will say. How did we know that your Torah was correct? How are we supposed to know everything? Who told us? Obviously, the answer is, there was prophecy all along. We all know to this very day, the Bible is one of the most popularly printed and read books in the world. And with everyone, over a billion people or more, reading the Bible, knowing the prophecies, how many of the political leaders who claim that they are in any ways religious, Christian or Jewish, believe them and act accordingly? I think we could say that the answer to that is 0.00. No one. So it says here that the first will then, a proclamation will go out to Zion. Right? It says, I have sent to Jerusalem a herald. I saw that there is no one. They have no advisors. No one who can be asked and given an answer. Indeed, they're all vanity. Their deeds are nothing, and their idols are empty wind. Now, this ends chapter 41. But I believe that we have to continue into chapter 42, at least for the first four verses, to continue this train of thought. I don't think the chapter breaks here are in the right place. So we read here, here is my servant, again, a reference to Israel, whom I support, my chosen one, whom I desire. And who is that servant? Didn't we just identify him in the previous chapter, in the eighth verse, being Israel? I have granted him my spirit, and I will pass judgment, and he will pass judgment on the nations. He will not cry out or raise his voice, or let his voice be heard in the street. Mashiach doesn't judge with ideology. He just tells it like it is. So this servant here could very easily be a reference to Mashiach personally. Now, doesn't that add confusion to who Isaiah 53, the famous suffering servant, is? Is it Messiah or is it Israel? The answer is, according to the Zohar, the mystical tradition, it's actually both. He will not cry out or raise a voice, let his voice be heard in the street. He will not break a bruised reed or put out a fading wick. He will pass judgment in truth. He will not grow dim or be bruised, contradiction Isaiah 53, until he establishes justice on earth. And the isles, again, those strange mention to these isles, await his teachings. Here is where I'll conclude this class. You see, the coming of Mashiach is a purpose, again, of instituting justice. He's not going to impose this justice militarily. He's not going to have to. He is simply going to get rid of the negative opposition in mankind and show everybody the truth. And in that light, the redemption will come. So needless to say, the nations of the world are going to freak out at this overwhelming show, that no matter what they would throw up against it, literally just will disappear. will completely disappear, and he will come and impose order and hold everyone accountable. Regather all the lost tribes and bring them back to his land. And don't ask, well, you know who's there right now and you know what's built there right now. None of it will be there. How will it disappear? Not by our hands. That's his job. He'll take care of it when the time comes. In the meantime, our job is to know and recognize that such a great intervention is definitely counting down to coming. And our job is to prepare ourselves to be the best human beings we possibly can, to rise up and be worthy to greet them when the time comes. So on that note, Bezrat Hashem, let's conclude this lesson. We'll continue with the prophecies of redemption of Isaiah in our next.